Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel.
Hello, Amos.
Hello, Greg.
Hey, you know, we just turned these big bright lights off that we have in here, but it's studio's getting ready for videoing. So
yes.
We're going to be on camera.
So you will all know the secrets of, of all the silliness that goes on during this show.
Oh, it still mystifies me why anybody would want to watch when they can listen and do something else. But I'm just inherently a multitasker. And so this will be available for all those who like that.
Okay. All right. Let's get started. Here's a question from...
We have nothing better to do but to look at us doing our show. Oh, here we go.
All right. Here's a question from KJ. In 1 Peter 2:18, it talks about slaves being submissive to masters, beatings, pain, and unjust treatment. It goes on in 1 Peter 3:1 to say wives, in the same way, be submissive. Can you explain what he means by in the same way?
Well, what this passage is a passage about submission to those who are in authority over you. And I think you see a similar kind of construction in Ephesians chapter 5, where he's talking about Christians being submissive to one another, but then he looks at different ways that submission is expressed in different relationships. And here you have the passage in 1 Peter 2 starting out. In verse 13, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it's to a king as the one in authority or to governors sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. So there's a submission to a particular authority who has particular latitude and liberties given by God to accomplish particular ends. Okay? Not everyone that we're supposed to submit to has the same kinds of authorities or liberties or latitudes in exercising their authority. Okay? And so, as servants, this is, I could add, in the same way, be submissive. That is, what's similar between servants and the rest of ours, the rest of us, verse 13, is that we're submitting, but the submission is in ways appropriate to the authority that's over us, okay? So when we see in chapter 3, verse 1, in the same way, I think that he's referring to not in the same way that slaves submit to masters or that citizens submit to kings, but rather in the same way, be submissive, and then he describes the appropriate way that that relationship reflects a submissive circumstance, a wife to husband. And by the way, what he describes is still pretty challenging, but it is not the same as slaves submitting to their masters or citizens submitting to their rulers. The distinction is in the different types of authority with different roles. The similarity is submission.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I mean, that's the way I read this, and it seems to make perfect sense. What it says here about wives submitting, though, has to do, is fairly aggressive. And I only say aggressive in light of the way our culture understands these kinds of relationships. I do not think it's aggressive biblically. And I actually did this once. I haven't done a commentary on it because I'm not brave enough yet. But on all the passages that talk about these kinds of things in the directions to husbands and the directions to wives, the directions to wives actually occupy more than twice as many references than directions to husbands. And they all, every single one of them, have to do with submitting to the authority, the proper authority and leadership of the husband. Many commentators and teachers I've seen, when they come to the Ephesians 5 passage, it says, husbands, love your wives, and wives, submit to your husbands, respect your husband's leadership, etc. And the way this is often taught is, listen, husbands, if you're not loving your wife properly, then your wives don't have to submit to you. Well, that isn't what it says. These are not bilateral commitments. If you do this, then he does this. It's unilateral. The husband is supposed to love his wife regardless of how his wife treats him, you know, and vice versa. And I think the same thing in these passages. So it is not a master-slave kind of relationship, or I should say master-servant, because that's what doulos also means. The concept of slave conjures up a picture of slavery in the United States that we experienced, and other slavery in the other world, parts of the world. But this word doulos is also translated servant, and the Old Testament Hebrew word for slave and servant are exactly the same as well. It was only until the turn of the 20th century that the translations started using the word slave more often than they use the word servant. It's an odd thing. But it ends up giving a false understanding in both testaments of some of these roles. It makes them sound much more extreme than they are. In any event, in the same way of chapter 3, 1 Peter, is referring to, in the same way, submit. Now, here's the details for wives and husbands. There are instructions for husbands here. Seven verses later, husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way. As with someone weaker, since she is a woman, show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. By the way, verse 8 then, he has a summary of the whole text. To sum up, all of you, be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but blessing instead. So that's a summary that applies to all of these relationships that are being described.
So I just want to comment on the question, the way it's worded, and say a couple things about that. It says the First Peter talks about slaves being submissive to masters, beatings, pain, and unjust treatment, which actually isn't actually what it says. I think that before I get to that, though, I want to say something that you said I want to emphasize. There are instructions for both sides. There are instructions here. The emphasis is on the instructions for people who are submitting. But there are certainly instructions for people who are
in the place of authority.
Yes, in the place of authority. Like you just read the part about what the husbands are to do. It's not like the New Testament has nothing to say for the people who are in authority. Also, there are plenty of instructions for them also. Mm-hmm. The idea is that everybody has a way that they're supposed to honor God in their role. Mm-hmm. So when it talks about the servant submitting to someone who is unreasonable, here's the passage. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are unreasonable, for this finds favor. If for the sake of conscience toward God, a person bears up under sorrows when suffering unjustly, for what credit is there if when you sin and are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and suffer for it, you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. For you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example for you to follow in his steps. And then it talks about how Jesus did not return
evil for evil.
Mm-hmm. He didn't revile when he was reviled. So the idea here is that our job is to reflect Christ and honor Christ in whatever role we have. And sometimes that means we will suffer unjustly. And all of these different things, but that doesn't give us the right to behave badly in response. So mm-hmm. our main concern should be that we follow what God has called us to do so that we reflect Christ to the world.
Keep in mind, 1 Peter is written to suffering Christians. In fact, the notion of suffering is in every single chapter. Verse 19 of chapter, I'm just paging because I've highlighted these here. Actually, maybe not the first. I'd have to look over carefully, but I got chapter 2, verse 20, verse 21, verse 23, chapter 3, verse 14, verse 17, chapter 4, verse 1, you know, and verse 13 and 15, and in chapter 5, verse 9 and 10, this book is written to suffering Christians, and it's describing how we ought to live, and this underscores what you were saying, Amy, regardless the context in which we are being being treated unfairly or suffering. And in addition to what Amy just pointed out, that suffering in certain relationships, being like Christ, it says, sanctify Christ as Lord in your heart, always being ready to make a defense for everyone who asks. Well, that's in the our apologetics verse, but in gentleness and reverence. And he introduces that by saying, who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what's good? But there are some. If you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you're blessed. Don't fear their insults. Do not be troubled. But, and there's our verse, sanctify Christ, make a defense, yet with gentleness and reverence. So this theme is throughout the book, and it's really about Christians facing all manner of suffering and difficulty in the culture, but even in individual relationships. And that's why the statement is made about servants, which, by the way, New American Standard translates as servants, not slaves, and then wives and husbands, different relationships to each other, to be harmonious, as he points out, kind-hearted, brotherly, humble in spirit.
And I also want to add that none of this is an excuse for people treating others unjustly. This is it's merely focusing on those who are in these roles of submission and explaining how they are to behave like Christ, even when they're, you know, treated unjustly. Mm-hmm. This is not a license for these masters to be harsh and unfair. In fact, we know it isn't, because, like I said, there are plenty of instructions for them as well to treat them, to treat them as their brothers. So, again, I just wanted to make sure people knew this wasn't an excuse for them.
I find a great summary verse, one that I know well because I have reminded myself of it frequently, in 1 Peter 4:19, the last verse of that chapter. Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God, now that's an important phrase, concept, that sometimes our suffering is what God has in mind for us, shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. You find yourself in a tough spot, here's what you do. I mean, there may be ways that you can appropriately interact to resolve it, but when push comes to shove, so to speak, and you're suffering according to the will of God, you entrust your soul to God and you do what's right. And what that looks like is described in this book, in the various relationships that he touches on.
All right. And also, I just want to say that doesn't mean that you are not allowed to leave a situation where someone is harshly treating you. I mean, in these cases, I don't think these people had that option. But Paul does say elsewhere that he says to slaves, get your freedom if you can. So it's not like he's saying you don't have the option of changing your situation. Although, again, in this case, I don't think these people probably did. Mm-hmm. But again, it goes back to the idea that he's not, because I know a lot of people take it that way, that this is some sort of license.
For abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go on to a question from Ted. I'm having trouble fully understanding John 14:15-19, and how one spirit can be in millions of people. Please discuss. Thanks.
Well, I guess my question would be, what exactly is the problem? How one spirit can be in 15 millions of people. Now, I think what's going on is hard. That's the question I would ask, Columbo style, and I'd want an explanation, see what the person... And it's not to stump somebody, it's to try to get clarity. Because I don't see a difficulty, but that's because I realize that spirits are immaterial and they are illocal. That means they don't... An immaterial thing occupies no material space. When we say that the spirit is in us, it's a manner of speaking, but we don't mean that the spirit is in us like a pea is in a pod. Okay? Because there you have two physical things that has a physical location relative to each other, one inside the other. When you have immaterial things, you can have the same thought in the mind of two different people at the same time. It's the same thought. You can have all kinds of immaterial awarenesses, principles of logic, which are immaterial abstract entities. They're real, or at least many people think they're real, and they don't have causal powers. They don't do anything. They're just abstract objects, but they're things that can be. This is the nature of a universal is that it's in more than one place at one time. And keep in mind, when we say place, we don't mean physically located, but it's manifest there. My soul is not in my body. My soul is immaterial. Demons are not in the room in the sense that bodies, human bodies are in the room. My soul is united with my physical body in a mysterious way, but that is in an ownership kind of way. So my body and my soul belong to each other. They go with each other. They influence each other, but they are not each other, and one is not in the other. One is material and the other is immaterial. So in a similar fashion, and maybe this is the easiest way to help people think about this, people can have the same thoughts in their mind. They can have the same concepts of the laws of logic or mathematics or all kinds of things. If we couldn't share the same thoughts, we couldn't communicate at all. So these same identical abstract entities can be in multiple places at one time. The difference with God is he's not abstract, he's personal, but he's also omnipresent. And so he's not only personally present everywhere, but he is dynamically present in the specific lives of Christians in a way that he's not with non-Christians, creating a new birth and then doing the things in the Christian that the Holy Spirit does. If a person is habituated to think of everything in a physical sense, it doesn't make sense to say that a physical thing is in more than one place at a time, unless you have some screwy time travel movies where you see yourself, you know, like in Back to the Future and stuff like that, but not in real life, okay? If we think properly, though, about immaterial things, this isn't a problem, I guess. I think that what people are doing is they're falling into the habit of thinking in terms of physicalism, and that's why this doesn't make sense. There's no reason it should be a problem, though, if you see immaterial things as being illocal. They don't locate themselves in a physical sense, but their presence can be felt in different ways.
But don't you think there's also a distinction between the Spirit of God, since God is omnipresent? I don't think every spirit is omnipresent.
No.
I think angels are localized in some sense. Would you agree with that?
Yes. They are. This is where philosophy has the language to describe these distinctions. I can't remember them all, okay? Even the famous point about angels, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, was not some foolish abstraction. It was meant to try to understand the nature of location of immaterial things. And so our souls are located, are connected with us in a particular way, in a unique fashion. The reason I made but our souls are themselves. They are limited in their ability to locate their impact. Okay, I was making the distinction with God because God is omnipresent does not mean he is in everyone in the sense that the Holy Spirit is in the regenerate person. That's why I was making a distinction between his personal presence everywhere and his active operation within the life and the nature of those who are regenerate.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks, Greg. We're out of time. All right. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. Please keep sending those questions to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.